Welcome to this podcast of the New York City Bar Association. In this episode, Making It Work, the in-house outside litigation counsel dynamic with Regeneron Pharmaceuticals, Inc. and Krieger, Kim, and Lewin. Christina Lewicki, a member of the City Bar's Litigation Committee, speaks with Arun Bhumik, Executive Director and Assistant General Counsel at Regeneron Pharmaceuticals, Inc., and Edward Y. Kim, co-founding partner of Krieger, Kim, and Lewin, LLP. They discuss the similarities between representing a corporate executive in an individual capacity and an institutional client, the differences between representing a founder-led and a legacy company, and the unique skills of a multicultural litigator. Opinions expressed are those of the speakers and not necessarily of the City Bar. Here's Christina Lewicki.
Welcome to Making It Work, the in-house outside litigation counsel dynamic. I'm Christina Lewicki, a member of the New York City Bar Association's Litigation Committee and the host of this podcast series, which brings together leading in-house litigation attorneys and their external counsel to discuss what makes their collaborations successful. I'm joined today by the team representing Regeneron Pharmaceuticals, Inc., a leading biotechnology company in nearby Tarrytown, New York. Arun Bhumik is a graduate of Harvard Law School and is executive director and assistant general counsel at Regeneron. There, Arun oversees all general litigation and government investigations, including investigations by the Department of Justice and other regulators, commercial disputes, shareholder litigation, regulatory litigation, product liability matters, and other disputes. Prior to joining Regeneron, Arun was the head of litigation and chief compliance officer of Time, Inc., and a partner at Manette Phelps and Phillips. Earlier in his career, Arun was a federal prosecutor in the fraud section of the Department of Justice in Washington, D.C. Arun started his career as an associate at Cravath, Swain & Moore, and a law clerk to Judge Stephen C. Robinson, United States District Court for the Southern District of New York. I'm also joined today by Ed Kim, a founding partner of Krieger, Kim, and Lewin. Ed represents multinational companies and individuals in cross-border disputes, criminal and regulatory enforcement actions, and investigations. Ed is an accomplished trial lawyer whose cases have involved allegations of securities and financial frauds, cryptocurrency fraud, money laundering, and Foreign Corrupt Practices Act FCPA violations. Ed co-founded the firm after serving for nearly a decade as an assistant United States attorney in the United States Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York. During his tenure as a federal prosecutor, Ed served as the chief of the Complex Fraud and Cybercrime Unit, where he oversaw the investigation and prosecution of sophisticated financial frauds, cybercrimes and cryptocurrency frauds, money laundering violations of the FCPA, criminal tax offenses, and healthcare fraud, and also served as a chief of the General Crimes Unit, where he trained and supervised dozens of the Southern District's newest prosecutors. Ed previously served as a law clerk for the Honorable Naomi Reese Buchwald of the United States District Court for the Southern District of New York. He received his law degree from Harvard Law School. To expand on these backgrounds, in a previous conversation, Arun and Ed shared with me that they are both first-generation Americans. Their parents emigrated to the United States from South and East Asia, respectively. In light of this commonality, we're going to include multiculturalism among the topics of today's discussion. Arun and Ed, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Thank you for having us, Christina.
Arun, what insights do you have to share with us on early stage collaborations between in-house and outside counsel?
Yeah, so I joined Regeneron after being in-house at Time, Inc. And I'd say the thing that I learned, and I sort of knew it as when I was outside counsel, but you really see it when you're an in-house lawyer, is how much when you're working for a company, the company is a business, and it has certain sort of, and I don't mean that it's sort of just profit driven. What I mean by that, it's an organization and it's an entity that has its own culture and it has its own, you know, the way it works and the way people internally think about things. And you know, when I started the company, that's something I needed to learn. Right. And so what I found working with outside lawyers is that the ones that work best with you know, with me and with the company are the ones who take the time up front to really learn and understand what's going on at the company, what drives, what motivates the company, what's important to the company, and learns the company's culture. And that's, to me, that's a sort of a big part, like in early stage or early in the relationship, to sort of, you know, starting it off strong and understanding what's going on here.
And how would outside counsel go about doing that beyond reading expansively about the company?
I'll give you one. I'll give you a story, not from Regeneron, but from a prior life when I was outside counsel, which is we were representing. We were representing a company, and they were involved in a dispute, and they decided to come to us after the dispute had been going on for a while. They were using some other firm, and it wasn't going well. And one of the questions we asked in the first meeting was, what are you looking to do? What are you trying to accomplish here? And the client paused and said, you know, in the last 2+ years of litigation, nobody has asked me that. And I thought, and it was very funny. And I think so translating that forward, I think it's about asking questions and really being comfortable asking questions. And part of my job as an in-house lawyer is to make sure those questions are being asked on some level. You know, I sit almost in two places, right? Because I'm the in-house lawyer. I'm at the client. On the other hand, I consider myself part when there's a litigation, I'm overseeing litigation. And I always tell my outside lawyers, don't think of me as the client. Think of me as a member of your team. And we're going to have very open dialogue. I get involved in sausage making, as Ed knows, right? And I just, you know, it's totally fine, because to me, the client is the business is my, you know, my clients are the client. I'm just a member of your team, and part of my job is to make sure my outside counsel understands what's motivating the company.
It's a baseline understanding.
Absolutely. I think it's probably, you know, one of the most fundamental things in any litigation, any investigation, any deal, whatever it is. I think understanding what exactly, what's driving the client. Why are we doing this? Why are we in this dispute? What are you trying to accomplish? I mean, those are sort of basic fundamental questions. And I think all lawyers know it. I think sometimes they forget to ask it, especially if they, you know, if it's a sort of matter that, you know, that they've handled before, or whatever it is, you know, like that sort of thing, you know, that can, you know, so I'll give you another sort of way this can come up. I work at a company that just, and me personally, I thrive myself on not thinking, sort of thinking outside the box. And when I hire outside counsel, of course, we look for counsel that have expertise. And it's great if a company has done, you know, this sort of litigation before. This has actually happened. And they've done this before. That's great. They've got expertise. The problem is then, like, the first thing that happens is let's think about this issue in a different way. And that, in that relationship, if the minute I get frustrated is if I hear it, and frankly, if I say it to people above me, that, you know, the reason we're making this argument, the reason we're taking this strategy or whatever it is, well, that's just how it's done. That's not going to fly. That's not going to fly for me internally, and it's not going to fly. Like, if you say that to me, I'm going to get frustrated. And if I say that to people internally, they're going to get frustrated. That's just not how we operate. And understanding that about our culture is important.
Ed, what's another important goal for outside counsel to pursue at the earliest stages of a partnership?
In terms of just general principles of collaboration, I would say one thing that, you know, I came out of government about a little over 4 years ago. In the early days, we were brought in to represent an institutional client, a financial services firm. And, you know, I think that was kind of an eye-opener for me in terms of another principle I think that, you know, I encounter a lot in all my representations, really, is sort of the importance of truth-telling and balancing that with sort of principles of client management. And, you know, I think early on, a lesson that I learned about building a solid relationship from the start is, at least my bias and, obviously no lawyer is going to come out and say we want to lie to a client, but I think there's a spectrum of, you know, how, where are you in the spectrum of sort of truth telling and, you know, giving the unvarnished advice as you see it versus, you know, maybe managing the client a little bit more. And those things are not necessarily, mutually exclusive. But, you know, an early lesson I saw was sort of that we were brought in to work alongside a big firm as co-counsel, and we would all have a meeting and then come back to the client and report on it. And the you know, our co-counsel, I would say on the spectrum, was maybe a little bit more inclined to, you know, to manage the client and manage expectations and present things in the most positive light. And we had a very sophisticated client who could perceive this, I think. And so it diminished the value of the advice given by the other law firm. And that client would then pick up the phone and call me and say, I want to hear your unvarnished take on what happened in that meeting. And it was a good reminder, not that anything the other attorney was saying was dishonest. It was a good reminder to me that, you know, I think sophisticated clients appreciate hearing, you know, just sort of the brass tacks of what happened. And, you know, of course, then they'll take your advice on what to do. But the sort of reporting on what had happened and your interpretation, I think, to me, it stressed the importance of, from the very beginning, emphasizing just, you know, total honesty and credibility as an advocate, both as an advocate and someone who can sort of report back accurately on an assessment of what's going on and the strengths and weaknesses of various positions. So to me, that's been, I think, an important lesson I've learned early about just how to start things off on the right foot.
Can I just weigh in on that point? I can't overstate how important the honesty point is, especially for, I'll say, for the person in my position, because I need the, and this actually gets into the point about think of me as a member of the team thing. Like, I need to understand completely unvarnished. How we then message it, so internally or what that, that can be a complicated question. And it's very difficult. It can be really challenging, as I'm sure Ed has found in his practice as well, because, you know, it's hard to tell the truth sometimes, and you got to message things the right way. Otherwise, it can, you know, it can cause further problems down the road. Another issue is, like, if you're ever, and I know you, I think you've done some plaintiff's work too. If we're on the plaintiff side of something, you know, we have to give, you know, the strength of our case. We have to be really, really honest internally. And a lot of times, but also it might be the case that our clients also just want it. Sometimes clients just want to be heard sometimes a little bit, right? And this is probably true on the defense side as well, but I feel like it just sort of more naturally comes up when you're a plaintiff. But they want their, and so, but we need to understand truthfully. Like, I personally need it completely unvarnished, and I need to give it, make sure people around me understand what the truth is. The messaging can get complicated, but the first step has to be complete unvarnished truth. Otherwise, it's going to get, things are going to go sideways.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think, you know, where the art in maybe the management of a relationship comes in is sort of, sometimes it's when and how to deliver the straight up, you know, brass tacks advice, because I agree, you know, I think about a lot in terms of relationship parallels of, you know, my marriage or friendships, and you are not likely to win the argument if, you know, every word that comes out of your spouse's mouth, you're jumping out like, well, that's wrong because X, you know, sometimes you just gotta wait and deliver it in at the right time and in the right way, in a way that's uncompromising maybe, but recognizing all the realities. And, you know, sort of when you say certain things can have as much effect as you know, how and what you're saying. But so there's definitely, there's definitely the right way to deliver something in the right timing. But I think that's right. So the baseline has to be truth telling. Like, if you're reporting about what happened at a meeting, or you're reporting about something you saw and that your in-house counterparts were not there to see, you know, there's no spin on that.
But I 100% agree that a client relationship is very, very similar to, like, being in a relationship, like in a marriage or something. I totally agree with that. I think of them very similarly.
On the topic of similarities, Ed, you represented many corporate executives in your government practice. Are there any similarities between representing a corporate executive in an individual capacity and representing a corporate institutional client?
when you represent an institution, it's not a monolith. And you're, I think a lot of your relationship with that client boils down to figuring out who the stakeholders are, how decisions get made, what are the political dynamics, and, you know, what's affecting, what's driving the decision other than just, I'm going to look up the case law and tell you what I think the case law says. I mean, that's just the starting point for any decision, right? What are the factors in the client's business that make that advice, you know, more relevant or less relevant? But the funny thing is that, you know, when I think the common myth is when you represent an individual, it's just so simple. It's just one person. It's not an organization. But I think often, just like with an institutional client, you're not delivering legal advice in a vacuum. You're taking into account many other considerations like finances, emotions, you know, especially in our white collar criminal practice area, you're dealing with someone's, you know, future. Are they going to go to jail? And, you know, so many other things that factor into just what a technical legal analysis is. And also, you know, increasingly you have, I think I've often found with our higher net worth individuals, it seems like the more zeros in someone's bank account, the more advisors they have. And suddenly you're not dealing with just one person. You're actually figuring out, in the same way you're navigating an institutional relationship, you're figuring out who has a client's ear, who has what agenda, how am I speaking to the, I'm speaking to the client through a trusted advisor. And what's that trusted, is that trusted advisor's agenda slightly different? Do they have the client's best interest in mind? And so you're navigating dynamics in a very similar way. So in some ways, the more I do this, the more I see a convergence, I think, in terms of, you know, how I have to navigate. It's often you're looking and trying to figure out what the landscape is. And, you know, a lot of it, I find the game is figuring out, you know, in a perfect world, you give the advice you think should be followed. The client follows that advice. And, you know, that perfect world exists in a small minority of cases. And often it's figuring out, you know, who the imperfect messenger that's going to get that advice and, you know, other factors that may be affecting how the client thinks about it. And, you know, and a lot of times I find myself giving advice. This goes both institutions and individuals where I say, well, listen, if we're living in a vacuum and you're asking me what path I think is most likely to avoid, let's say, the least amount of time in jail, I can give you that answer. But, you know, then a client tells me, well, I'm willing to do more time in jail if I can do X, Y, and Z. And then, you know, then you sort of have to change everything up. And the same way with institutions, you know, we can render advice that may be very little value if we're not actually taking into account the practical realities of what the institution's facing and saying, well, listen, yeah, that sounds like a great claim, but it's not worth that much to us, or, you know, for business reasons, we need to do something different. And you have to adapt to that, because I think being a good counselor and advisor means, you know, the more you can sort of deliver holistic advice, I think the more effective you can be in helping to guide clients. And I think that applies to both institutions and individuals.
Arun, do you share Ed's perspective on the dynamics of representing an individual versus representing a company?
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And it actually gets back to, I think, the first question you asked, which was, you know, getting the relationship off, like how to build that strong relationship. I think what Ed just described is the process that needs to happen in order to effectively build that relationship, which is understanding the dynamic. So as an, you know, someone who has an institutional, effectively, you know, I have one institutional client, my company, the company I work for. And, you know, but understanding those dynamics, both for me and for my outside lawyers, you know, everything Ed just said, like there's a company, but the company is made of people. What are the internal dynamics that are going to drive them? What are the internal business motivations? There's, you know, any number of times where people, you know, this happened when I was outside counsel, this happened at prior companies that I worked for. Like, you know, what is, again, like the question I asked earlier, like, why are we doing this? Or like, what is actually going on? What's the business thing that's driving this dispute? Because nobody, I mean, what we were talking about here is litigation. Nobody like like wakes up, you know, is born and be like, what I want to do in my life is to get into legal disputes with people, right? Like they happen for reasons, or if that person exists, like God bless, right? But like, you know, they happen for, because something has gone wrong usually, right? And so understanding like, well, how did we get here? And asking those questions, and then being able, and then delivering legal advice and doing it in a way that's effective. You know, like there's, you know, the number of times, but again, at my current company and prior companies where you, if I was an outsider, like, why is the company doing this? Or why, like, this just doesn't seem that like it's a big deal. And the answer is it's a big deal to somebody internally. And that somebody has enough, you know, is driving this. And that person is an important person at the company. So there've been, you know, there are times they're like, maybe this isn't that big a deal, but it's important to that person. And that person's an important person. And there, and it's, I don't mean that in a way that's sort of sycophantic. I just mean that in a way that, no, they're getting to the relationship point, like the, being in a marriage, like their position has value. It's valid, right? Their emotions are valid. Their perspective on things are valid, and it needs to be validated. Whether or not how you land or whether you go to litigation or how it's resolved, that comes later. But a threshold issue is just understanding, you know, that about your client. I think it's critical. The thing I'd say, you know, just, and this is just a very practical point about individuals versus companies, and I'm sure Ed, you found this, like when you've got, you know, when I was outside counsel and I was dealing with a client that had a sophisticated in-house legal department, that had in-house litigators, that was one type of representation. A different type of representation is a client that maybe has an in-house legal department and it's small, and maybe they don't even have any in-house litigators. They maybe have some transactional lawyers or something, but they're not that. And that was a different kind of relationship. And then you had clients when I represented individuals, and today as an in-house lawyer, I have clients that are non-lawyers at all, right? They're very sophisticated. They're sophisticated business people. I work with some of the smartest, you know, scientists in the world, right? And they're very, but they also have, they don't understand the legal system at all, right? And sort of constantly reminding, it's just something you need to keep in mind. And that's what I found. It's sort of like having an individual representation when I was outside counsel. Like there's very basic things that they don't, you know, that they might not understand. And you have to sort of talk, you know, you have to be able to communicate that. I know we're going to talk about sort of, you know, cultural issues a little later. But to me, a big part of like my effectiveness in doing that is coming from, you know, a culture where, or being in an environment where, you know, I need to learn to communicate with people that maybe don't speak my language, right? Or I, you know, and it's sort of, I think it was sort of a, almost on some level, like sort of a training ground to be able to learn to communicate with, you know, anybody and everybody, because it's an important part of our job.
Yeah, I totally agree with that too, just about what you were saying about in terms of understanding the dynamic of, you know, is this an institutional client with sophisticated in-house counsel, or, you know, what are we dealing with? And I feel the dynamic changes a bit depending on the answer to that. And in one respect, I think sometimes, you know, if I find that there is a sophisticated in-house legal group, and they're very active, in some ways, you know, and I know you made the point earlier that you will tell outside counsel, like, you're not the client, and you're part of the legal team. I think that's more the exception than the rule in terms of sometimes the mindset of in-house counsel who interact with us. But I do find a little bit the dynamic, you know, shifts a little bit where I may spend, if it's depending on how built out that in-house counsel group is, I may spend a lot more time than just dealing with them. And they're totally the conduit to the business side, and I'll have much less visibility on that. And in situations like that, I do find like, my mindset is a little bit different where I try to have this focus, I think, no matter what, but oftentimes then they become, my focus is sort of trying to understand how I can help them and empower them within their organizations, right? And, if they've brought us in to do X, then I think I try to be pretty single-minded about making sure we're doing our best to, you know, to empower them, to make them look good, to equip them with everything they need to be able to convey the advice to the business folks. And I think the dynamic can shift a little bit in that way. And I that's how I sort of see it on the receiving end sometimes.
Arun, why do you tell outside counsel that you want to be part of their legal team?
there's a couple of reasons I do that. One, and it actually relates to a lot of issues we've talked about already, is that I want to get information unvarnished. And so that's one way to do that.
And second, I like outside the box creative legal thinking, and my ability to participate in that process, I think, encourages that.
There's absolutely any number of times where working with very, very sophisticated top law firms in the city, you know, top people, top litigators, and, you know, can we do this? Like, what about this? No, that won't work. That won't work. We researched it, but why not? The way I was trained as a lawyer was just keep asking, keep pressing, keep asking the question. Like, you know, why isn't this the answer? Let's keep pushing it. And there are absolutely times that, you know, top lawyers have given me one, like, say, no, we can't do that. And no, we absolutely can't do that. We might not win, but it's worth a shot. And there might be a reason why it's worth a shot, right? And so sort of pushing your outside, I like to push my outside counsel, and like sort of being treated like a member of the team is, you know, is part of that. I also just like lawyering. I like thinking about a lot of different issues. And one of the great parts about being an in-house lawyer is that in the same day or the same week, I can, you know, deal with government investigations and a commercial dispute and challenge some government regulation and, you know, an employment, you know, advise the employment lawyers on sort of an employment litigation matter, which I don't get that involved in, but, you know, every once in a while I'll win. I can do that all in the same day. That's sort of one of the great job, you know, fun of being an in-house lawyer. And I just like, I like law. I like, like since law school, I just like it. Right. And so being a member, like being part of the brainstorming process, you know, it's just, I find it invigorating. I can never do that. There's a lot of in-house lawyers, and I'm sure you've seen this, Ed, that like, I think what they do is manage cases, keep people informed, look at the bills, make sure. And that's an important part of my job, but it's also like the part of my job I like the least, you know? And so I like to get involved for that reason as well. It's just like, it's good. You get to learn the team. I know the associates. When the associates have kids, I send them gifts, gifts for the babies, like that sort of thing. I enjoy that. And so that's why I do it. And that's what I found. And I think it's positively received. If it's not, you know, like I don't hear it.
You have to really discount Arun's observation because everyone's going to be nice to the teacher.
The waitress smiled at me, you know.
But in all cases, I think that's a great approach to have.
Yeah.
Prior to this recording, when we initially met, you told me that the two of you have been friends since law school. What aspects of your friendship are particularly helpful in your professional collaborations?
Yeah, I think it's a good question, Christina. You know, I think having known each other for as long as we have, it almost accelerates things and cuts out a lot of, you know, what we might otherwise need to do, which is to improve lines of communication and build trust. We obviously have a deep reservoir of trust from just having seen each other in social settings over, I actually don't even want to say how many years, but that depth of experience, I think, is really helpful. I think gives us a way to almost, you know, shortcut or cheat what we might otherwise need to do, and gives us a great foundation, I think, to work from. And I think it cuts out a lot of potential miscommunication and facilitates us, you know, there's a lot that's unspoken. And I think that's a good thing. We're able to just really cut to the chase when we work with each other.
Yeah, I echo everything. You know, and I think I never thought about it, but you're right. There was a little bit of almost cheating on it because, you know, we knew each other for so long. But it really, what was great about the working relationship was exactly what Ed described. It was the ability to be completely, you know, candid, honest about everything. And it's, you know, and that's the relationship that I want with all of my outside lawyers, right? And we just had like a 20-year head start on that, right? And so and that's why it was, you know, it was a great working relationship, because again, like I can, you know, if something I knew I could be completely upfront about, what for example, what the internal dynamics are and why, you know, to the point we were talking about earlier, it was very important for Ted to understand what was going on at the company and why this was an issue. And if I had an outside counsel, I'd need to convey that. And I didn't know well that I need to convey that information. But I need to convey that information in a way that was appropriate to the fact that, like, you know, we don't know each other that well. I mean, you're new to the company. And, like, you know, how I go about explaining the internal dynamics, you know, it's different if I don't know the outside counsel as well. With Ed, I can just, like, here's what's going on, right? And, like, and here's what I think we need to do. And it can be a totally relaxed a very productive conversation about it. And that's what I would eventually want with all my with all my outside lawyers. The other thing I just liked about working with Ed, and this is particular about Ed in particular, but, you know, and obviously other lawyers as well, like, there's just what I really like is practicality. Another thing that I really like, and working with Ed, another great thing about the relationship was that we knew each other, we trusted each other. I trusted his judgment, and Ed and his team were very practical, right? Like, and, like, they understood. Once they understood what was going on, what the dynamic of the internal dynamic was, what the business motivation was, you know, getting really, you know, thoughtful, practical solutions to things. I think, and you and I have talked about this in the past, I think a lot of that comes from your government experience. And, like, a lot of attorneys that have worked in government, and then go back into private practice, you sort of have to, like, learn to be practical and learn to make practical decisions because you don't have the same sort of luxuries of time and resources as you do when you're, you know, if you spend your entire career working at, you know, so-and-so big firm that is, you know, basically representing a bunch of big banks or whatever. And, like, there's never an endless budget, but you got a lot of resources when you're working on a matter like that.
Ed, Arun just brought up the value of your government experience in your collaborations with him. Can you expand on that?
I often think that being, you know, as I was a federal prosecutor for about a decade, and a lot of lawyers, I think, who kind of come up and get trained in, you know, so let's say a large law firm, in some ways, it's a long time before they actually make decisions, which sounds odd, but they support decisions. They give advice. They, you know, they analyze issues. They give 10 options to the client, but they never decide. And I think being a prosecutor, if anything, it teaches you a lot of things, but one of the great things it teaches you is to be a decision maker and actually be the one who has to make the call. And when you start doing that, I think you realize, like, okay, there are 15 contingencies that we could spend a lot of time looking at. And I can be the kind of prosecutor who will spend all my time thinking about those contingencies and never moving a case forward. Or I can figure out what are the two that really drive this decision, do enough work that I can figure out, you know, okay, which one suggests which route, and then make the decision and move. And I think when you're oriented that way, it makes you more able to understand a client who has to do that, right? At the end of the day, the client has to make a decision, and they can't take, it's less valuable for them to receive a memo with 15 contingencies and saying, well, maybe yes, maybe no. And if yes, that may be so, or that a little bit more, a little bit less. And at the end of the day, I think a lot of clients want to say, well, yeah, but what would you tell me? What would your advice be? And the more you can put yourself in the shoes of the decision maker, I think the more helpful that is. And I think having been a government lawyer and prosecutor, that really helps with that. You're sort of saying, okay, I'm comfortable making decisions. And I know when I tell you, like, hey, listen, there's three options, and here are the pros and cons, and this is one, if you're asking me for my advice, I would take number one. And to understand, to be comfortable with the idea that, okay, you can deliver that advice and still say, but listen, number one comes with some downsides, but here's sort of the ballpark percentage I put on, and I would still go for it. And I think a lot of lawyers are uncomfortable with that because no decision is perfect. And there's a lot of fear out there about saying, well, I don't want to be on record as having said you should do this when, you know, there's the percentage contingency that something else could happen. And I think after you've made a certain number of decisions in your career, you just sort of say, like, well, listen, obviously I'll caveat it, but everybody's got to decide something. And if you don't, you're paralyzed. And that can be worse for your client. So I sometimes think that training of just the muscle memory of making decisions and having to take information in and take a step forward is a very useful background to have.
I totally agree. That's sort of the sort of thing I was alluding to earlier. and look, there's a lot of great lawyers out there that have a lot of different backgrounds. But I think Ed's right, like the sort of being a prosecutor, being in government, like it's just this really compressed like period. Like you're just like, you have to do it and you get trained to do it very quickly. And I think it definitely is a tremendous value for that reason. And I think everything Ed said is right. Like from an in-house lawyer perspective, like that's also a lot of what being an in-house lawyer is being able to make decisions and doing it with, you know, even though you don't have all the information, but you sort of, you make the best decision you can make based on the information available to you and being comfortable with that. And being able to advise the client based on that. And look, again, telling them what the risks are and all that, and all, but being comfortable, you know, providing that advice and making that decision. It's a lot of what being an in-house lawyer, just a really important part of that, of the job. So I think like for all the reasons that I just said, I totally agree.
Well, now I'd like to turn the questions over to the two of you. Would you ask each other a question?
Ed, I'm curious, what has been the most meaningful representation that you've had to you?
Ah, okay. Yeah, that's a tough one.
Sorry, I feel like that. This is like it's like a Terry Gross question.
what I would say is it's a close call, but the one that probably comes to mind immediately is an individual representation we had where we represented somebody who was not a typical client for us. He was a civil servant. We were brought in by a civil agency to represent him in connection with the investigation. And I was, having spent time with him and looked at the record, I was quite convinced that he had not violated any laws. He was being investigated by a prosecutor's office, and real salt of the earth type client. Took our advice, didn't sort of accepted it as we were the experts, and he followed everything we asked him to do. He did what we suggested. Absolute silence from the prosecutor's office, and then after a gap of I was almost a year or more, suddenly they resurfaced and we're contemplating charging him with a crime, and which is always the most stressful, I think, situation for us. We represent some people who have crossed the line, and but there are others who have not, and it takes a lot of work to walk a prosecutor's office back from that. And so that was quite an endeavor to get the prosecutor's office in this case to sort of see the world which I think was the accurate way to see it, from our client's standpoint. And, it took a lot of process and appeals up the chain. And, at the end of the day, they, I think, made the right decision and told us they were not going to be charging him. And I would say that ranks up there because this is somebody who, I really thought had acted in good faith, and also the way he was as a client, I think, just sort of, trusting. He sort of placed his trust in us completely. And, it's, I think sometimes clients will do that, and we can't change the world, or we can't, determine an outcome. But in this case, everything aligned, and, he walked away as he should have without any charges. So that probably ranks up there for me, as being one of among the more meaningful ones. Question for you, Arun. I'm curious kind of, especially because you've now had the outside and in-house, perspective. Something I thought I might ask is sort of, how, if at all, right, coming onto the other side of the in-house side, how has that shaped your view on just sort of how you think about diversity in the profession? Like, I wonder if that's impacted your assessment at all.
Absolutely. So the thing that I realized after being an in-house for a little while is, it's easy to overstate this, so I don't want to overstate it, but how excellent women and attorneys of color who have achieved success in their careers, how excellent they are. And it really drives how I think about my hiring. There's a lot of excellent lawyers of all stripes, obviously. But there's what I found is like when if there's a female partner at a law firm who has, or an attorney of color, and they've, you know, and they may partner at their firm or their head of a practice or whatever, I'm almost universally impressed by them. And about internally too, at you know, the companies that I've worked for, that's also been the case. And I think it's because like you got to like work like twice as hard to get there, and they've made it. And they're like, and I'm always so wildly. It's amazing to me how this has been, just how I've seen over the last. I've been an in-house lawyer now for 4 or 5 years now, and I've just I found this kind of, you know. Almost like a sort of a universal truth to it. And I actually talk about it with, you know, my colleagues, and they're in agreement on it. And then I start thinking about, but also another thing, an important answer to your question is that I absolutely feel like if there's the profession's making progress and it needs to make more progress. And it's going to come from me. It's going to come from the client side. That's the only way it's going to happen. And like part of me feels like sort of, you know, I have a lot of, you know, ethical obligations, and I have obligations to my client, and then I sort of also have a moral obligation to make sure that we're also, and those two things aren't two different things. They're the same thing on some level, right? Like getting the best result for my client, you know, getting the best representation of outside lawyers is hand in hand with making sure that, you know, we have diverse attorneys representing us, and because it's best for the profession, it's best for the company, it's best for our outcomes. Those two things are all aligned. When I became an in-house lawyer, it just became crystallized. Like, this is an important thing that I need to, you know, I need to focus on it, because if you don't focus on it, it's very easy to lose sight of it.
And how have you focused on it? You mentioned that the push for progress has to come from the client side, from your side. What are some of the initiatives that you either originated or have been involved in to create more diverse, equitable, and inclusive legal teams?
Sure. So, great question. I'm not losing track of time. Probably a year ago, you know, internally, informally, I think, and especially in the litigation group at our company, we always thought about diversity issues and in our hiring. But we probably, you know, it was sort of ad hoc. On some level, it still is ad hoc. And I think that's true at a lot of companies. But, you know, about a year ago, we wanted to do more. And so we had a series of DE&I initiatives at the company. But one of them that I, helped lead up was just an effort to just look at our outside counsel and what can we do to diversify them. So we got involved. The ABA has a little initiative that's been around, you know, for a long time on these issues. So we got involved in that. We sort of have worked on changing internal policies and how we think about our hiring, how we think about diversity issues, how we track it, right? Because you don't know how well you're doing until you actually look at your numbers, like that sort of thing. So these are all, but to be candid, like these are all works in progress, and it's a challenge. It's a real challenge because it's a tough nut to crack. I recall when we graduated from law school, this being a conversation about clients, you know, driving it. And then, you know, we graduated in 2004, right? And I remember when I was a first year associate, you know, reading about initiative, like, and it's now, you know, what, 2021, so 16 years, I can't do math, 17 years later. And we're still talking about it, right? So it's a tough nut to crack, right?
Why is it a tough nut to crack? What's the hardest part about it?
What's the hardest part about hiring diverse attorneys, you mean?
Yeah.
That's a good question. I think it is. So I'll tell you, I don't know if this is the hardest, but a hard part of it is when you have a significant matter, the easiest thing to do is to hire a person that's done this for a very long time. it's the safest thing to do as an in-house lawyer. The so-and-so has done it. They've done it for a long time. If it's like something that the board's interested in, like you gotta, like the board, like you gotta make the, you know, there was an old saying, you know, back in the day, like no one ever lost their job for hiring IBM or like using IBM or something. Like this was like back in like the '80s or something, right? When like IBM just dominated, you know, business, you know, technology infrastructure and stuff. So you just make the safe choice, right? And if the safe choice is, in somebody who's done it for a long time and it's 2020, if you want somebody who's been doing this sort of work or has expertise, has been representing pharma companies for 20 plus years, you got to go back to somebody who's been doing this since the 90s. And that's going to be an old white man, probably. And so you got to be willing to take risks. You know, and that's just, and that's a hard thing to do sometimes, but you got to be willing to sort of take some risks. But that's a challenge. And it's again, we've been talking about this. I don't know how long the profession's been talking about it, but at least since we graduated law school in 2004, the profession's been talking about it, and we're still working on it, and we got to keep working on it.
Ed, do you have any thoughts on the scope of the effort to bring DEI into the law firm setting in general and to your firm in particular?
In the law firm setting, you know, I see it, we think about this a lot too. We're a small firm, so we don't have many policies. I think we do it informally by trying to force ourselves to reach outside our typical pools to find applicants. Because the other issue I find, and this speaks a little bit to Arun's observation, you know, I think the challenge is that by the time you're in a law firm or in-house counsel, you're already looking at accumulated effects of all kinds of systemic issues, which cause there to be less and less diversity at every step. And then when you start talking about specific practice areas like litigation or white collar, you see that effect even more magnified. So our pool of applicants for when we're just hiring attorneys is already pretty constrained. We're not seeing as many diverse candidates as we'd like. And you know, we don't hire straight out of law school. We look for top tier candidates who are coming out of clerkships and top tier firms. So we're in some ways sitting on top of the hiring processes of others. And so I find that to be the challenge sometimes, is that the numbers just aren't there that we would like to see. And I also agree with Arun that obviously this is something that was being talked about, has been talked about for decades now. And I hope that, you know, I have thought often that this time around, when I heard about in-house counsel making certain requests of outside counsel to make sure that there were diverse people on the teams, my hope was that this was going to be a stickier change, that the force has to come from the clients to force law firms to really make changes on this. So my hope is that we're going to see more concrete changes.
And I will say, we're making progress, I think, and I think there's just more progress to be made. But just as to Ed's point about the client driven, like 100%, we talk about diversity issues when we hire. We tell firms before they come in to pitch, this is important to us. There have absolutely been instances where firms have brought in diverse teams, but the diverse, the female, the attorneys of color, you know, they're not giving, you know, in the pitch, they don't have any kind of speaking role. They're just kind of there. And that's very obvious to us. And so now I tell the clients, you know, the outside law firms that are coming to pitch in advance, I like to like prep them help them make a good pitch. And I say, like, that's not going to fly. You got to make sure they have a role. And then there have absolutely been instances where we've hired law firms and then the diverse attorneys, the attorneys of color, the female attorneys then sort of fade away, and they then aren't given opportunities to then work on the case or do meaningful work on the case. And that's something that, you know, and to the point about sort of being very involved in my matters, you know, there have absolutely been times where we've said, you know, you brought a diverse team, but then they're not really, we're not getting sort of we're not getting that when it comes to the actual work being done. And we've had those conversations with the sort of the lead partners on a case. And, you know, it's also about, like, I have absolutely said, you know, this was at my prior company, but, you know, there was one time I said to our outside, there was some motion, I forget what it was, you know, sort of a meaningful, it wasn't like a summary judgment motion, but it was like a meaningful argument to be had in court. And I, like a few weeks ahead of time, I called the partner in the case, like, hey, can you just like let the fee, she was like, you know, probably 6-7 years out of law school, a woman. And I was like, you know, let her do it. Like we should have her do it. And there's a strategic point to be made too, because I thought it was sort of you know, it could go either way, right? The judge can go either way on it. And I was like, I think the judge also would like to see it. You know, and I think it was a female judge, and I said, let's have the younger attorney who's a woman, let's give her a chance to do this. I think the judge will like it. I think it'll, you know, and it just overall, it's a good thing. And so like, those are conversations we absolutely have with our outside lawyers.
Arun, you mentioned that while progress has been made, more needs to be made. I'm wondering when that progress that's being made becomes meaningful. What does meaningful progress in the area of diversity, equity, and inclusion mean to you?
That's a great question. I don't know. That's a really great question. Maybe you know it when you see it, right? But I don't know. I don't know if there's like a metric, because I'm trying hard not to say like, well, when 50% of the GCs of the Fortune 500 are women, then that's meaningful progress. It's not that. It's more subtle than that. But you know, I was, as an example, I was talking to somebody actually just last night, and they were telling me they were talking about a mutual person that we knew that had advanced in their career. But what this person was telling me was that there was a time when they weren't successful and they weren't really getting the traction they needed. And the reason was they were a really good lawyer, but they had taken sort of five, six years in the middle to work part-time after they had children. And so then when they, and then it took a long time after that for them to really start getting traction in their career again. But before he even told me that, there was something else. I was like, there seemed to be a gender issue. And then he explained that. I was like, okay, now I get it. Like, of course. And like when stuff like that doesn't happen anymore, yeah, that'll be meaningful progress.
How about you, Ed? Anything to add?
I definitely grew concerned, you know, when I started hearing about certain companies demanding that X percentage of attorneys be diverse attorneys or forcing the law firms to quotas. Obviously, I grew concerned about that this was just a window dressing exercise. And for some companies, maybe it is. And for some law firms, maybe it is. But I do also happen to think that progress has to start somewhere. And by forcing, even if law firms are doing it through gritted teeth, by forcing them to put attorneys of color on their teams or forcing them to show up for a pitch with, you know, attorneys that look different, I think good things will happen. I have a baseline optimism about that. And so maybe we're forcing it in a very artificial way, but, you know, we've tried a lot of non-artificial ways and that doesn't be working much either. So I'm perfectly happy to give it a shot to have this sort of a forcing mechanism where companies say to their outside lawyers, hey, we need to see people who look different.
So, I mean, it's interesting. One thing you asked earlier was sort of challenges to the diversity. Actually, that actually brings up a really good one that didn't occur to me earlier, which is that a challenge is that we haven't found a perfect solution yet, and there's a challenge to like trying imperfect solutions that people don't want to try, which is interesting because you don't really find that in other spaces. People are willing to try imperfect things, but sometimes. By the way, I'm not speaking about our company now. I'm saying sort of in the profession, sort of in the conversation generally, is that like, when you have the conversation, Ed's point about, well, this feels a little artificial, this isn't, and there's like counterpoints to be made, well, that might not work, or, you know, what about this and what about that? And therefore progress isn't made because we haven't found the perfect solution yet. And that's not how generally decisions get made. And when it comes to other issues, right? Why on this issue do we need the perfect solution before we try to fix anything?
How important are mentors to catalyze progress in this area? What role do mentors play in the development of diverse, equitable, and inclusive legal teams?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. It's something I think about a lot. And, you know, both Arun and I think, are involved in mentoring through different the Asian American Bar Association and other organizations. But, you know, when I was a junior attorney, I look back now and it's kind of funny because I didn't really receive much mentorship, I felt. Or to the extent I got sort of informal advice, it was often coming from someone who didn't look like me. That's not to say it wasn't good advice or wasn't valuable, but it was notable. And it's something I almost, you know, internalized and didn't really even think about or really consciously realize until much later in my career when I was a prosecutor. You know, towards the latter half of my service as a prosecutor, I served under Preet Bharara, the U.S. attorney, and June Kim eventually. And that was really the first time as I got more senior in the U.S. attorney's office. I remember it struck me on more than one occasion when I was sitting down and they were the ones who were really, the senior folks in the room. And, you know, we would crack jokes, talk about cases, but, you know, in moments of lightness when they crack jokes, often the jokes were, or many times they had different cultural reference points than the ones I had previously heard. And that was the first time there were definitely moments when I thought to myself, hey, I'm on the inside of this joke for once. You know, that's a small example, but just that a different environment. And then obviously I was able to get in some ways, you know, especially as I became more senior, was sort of more closely mentored, in particular by June Kim. And that was that for me, I remember thinking to myself, this is the first time I've really had a mentor in my career who's Asian American. Someone I'm working for. And I could see so many effects of that, big and small, but just the ability to communicate more clearly and have a shared area. As an example, you know, when I was, I think I was elevated to my first supervisory role as a prosecutor, you know, when June Kim was the chief of the criminal division and, you know, he asked me if I would be interested in taking his position. And, you know, I had at the time, it was sort of, there was a lot of family stuff going on, and I made some reference to the fact that I wanted to speak about it with my family. And I think I may have even included my mother-in-law in that discussion or something, but, you know, we joke about it. It's become a constant source of jokes since then, but the jokes are sort of knowing in the sense that, you know, there's maybe a different way as Asian Americans, you know, we're maybe tighter knit with some of our extended family and, responsibilities we have to another generation. And in some ways, there's just a level of understanding about something like that. Again, it became a joke, but maybe if I had said that, or maybe I wouldn't have felt free to say that to somebody, you know, let's say, who is not Asian American, or if I had said it, maybe that would have been misunderstood, or, you know, so that's just maybe a tangible example of something that really was directly related to my being elevated to a different position that, you know, I look back on as a way that, you know, wow, there's someone who kind of understood what I was talking about and understood where I was coming from and that didn't really happen earlier in my career. And I think to me, opened my eyes to how important it is for, attorneys of color to have that. And I think maybe before I sort of knew that in my head and didn't really understand it. And having been through that experience, I think it's really important to me to look for ways. Obviously I still seek out mentors, still have some of those mentors, but look for ways to mentor younger attorneys, attorneys of color, Asian American attorneys, because I think there's a real value to it that maybe I hadn't appreciated when I was a more junior attorney.
Yeah, see, like the cultural touchstones, they're really, they're important in subtle ways. Like I remember there was early in my career, this wasn't me, but there was an Asian American associate, another associate at the law firm, and I recall, like, obviously he's a success, he was a elite law grad, he was obviously at a very big law firm, he was obviously making money. But he had sort of grown up in the area. I forget where he grew up. It was like in Jersey or maybe in Queens or something, or in Westchester. And he was living with his parents. Like, he was right out of law school and he was living with his parents. And people thought it was the oddest thing. Like, whoa. He's living. And like, I remember I that didn't happen to me, but like, that's pretty common. Correct me if I'm wrong. That's not unusual in the Asian American community. Like, you graduate from college or law school or whatever it is, you're a professional, you make money. eventually, yeah, you move out and you have a life. But like, there's a time early in your career, you still live with your parents, not because you're not independent, because it's like financially smart to do, like to save a little bit of money, because you also don't have generational wealth in the same way, right? Like, you know, so you need to start building that. Like, you know, you're in, you know, a profession, you've got people and you're all sort of making the same salary, but they also have, you know, their family has generational wealth. I'm not saying like, you know, Kennedy Rockefeller wealth, but there's some degree of sort of upper middle class wealth that like, you know, recent immigrants just don't have. They haven't built that yet. Right. And so you've got to start building that. And one way to do that is, for example, to buy property and buy property early. Like, you know, not, I don't need to live in the cool neighborhood right out of law school. I'm going to live with my parents in Jersey and commute in and save a little bit of money so I can buy some property, so I can start building sort of generational wealth. And that's something that, like, I don't think, you know, people who aren't of that background, it just doesn't even occur to them that that's what's going on. They just thought it was odd. I remember the, you know, it was somebody said to me, wait, you grew up, so I'd grown up in Queens. And there was some, I forgot the restaurant, like some like mainstay New York restaurant that's been around for decades and everybody goes there. And there was something and they're like, oh, like, and the restaurant came up and like, oh, you've never been there? Like, wait, how could you grow up in New York and not go to that restaurant? It's like, because my parents are like South Asian immigrants in Queens. Like, we didn't go to that fancy restaurant in Manhattan growing up. What are you talking about? And then like, and here's like, it's a very funny one. When I was like a third or fourth year associate, the context doesn't matter, but basically there was some like, I'd never heard of Crosby, Stills and Nash. That's, and it became like this joke at the firm with my mentors at the firm. Like, and they were white and they were great mentors and I learned a lot from them. And it became a joke because at some point this had come up and I thought Crosby, Stills and Nash was a law firm. And they're like, you've never heard of Crosby. How could you not hear of Crosby, Stills, and Nash? And I was like, I know why I'd never heard of Crosby, Stills, and Nash, because how would I have heard of Crosby, Stills, and Nash? Where would someone my age? Is because they would have learned it from their parents. Like, oh, you got to listen to Crosby, Stills, and Nash. Like, no, I never heard of Crosby, Stills, and Nash. My parents listened to Bollywood music growing up. Like, I know Radiohead, right? But I don't know Crosby, Stills, and Nash. So like get off my back, right? Like, and it became a joke at the firm, but there's like sort of a truth to like what Ed's saying about sort of cultural sort of touch points that if you're sort of not from the, like, if you're white, you don't even understand what it means not to be.
Right. Arun, what are your thoughts on mentorships and DEI?
I've been fortunate enough to have some really good mentors at various points in my career. And they were older white men, it just is, but we just got along and I did good work for them and they became great mentors and great friends. So you can sort of find it anywhere. They weren't formal mentoring, they were informal mentoring relationships, but they were absolutely mentoring relationships. And I've told them, like, I'm a better lawyer today because of those mentoring relationships. So you can find them anywhere. It's important to have. I will say, so here's another cultural point, and Ed, tell me if you disagree. The idea of like finding mentors and building a career using finding mentors is also a little bit of a foreign concept to Asian Americans, right? Like, the way to get ahead, if you're Asian American, the way you get ahead is study hard, do well in school, get a job, keep working hard. As long as you keep working hard, you're gonna, like, that's what's gonna happen. That's not true. I've said this to, you know, after I became a partner at a law firm, I would say this to young associates, or like, or we had a paralegal who was Asian American who was going to law school. I told him that just straight up, like, you gotta do, like, I know it's not going to feel natural to you. You got to build mentoring relationships. It's not about working. You got to work hard. You got to do well in school. You got to then work hard and do well in your practice. You got to do all that. But that's not that's 20% of it or 40% of it. Then you got to find the right mentor. You got to find sponsors to like help you build your career. And it's completely unnatural to Asian Americans.
I totally agree with that. And I think that's one of the reasons why I feel almost like a sense of responsibility to mentor people, to kind of try and, you know, because I look at myself as a young lawyer, and that's sort of the mindset I had, because, you know, you're doing your job well, was sitting at your desk with your head down, and the socializing part was really, that was not really a part of my job. And, you know, I think especially now, the more senior you get in any profession, you realize how important the soft things are, of networking and building relations and maintaining them. And that's just not something culturally, you know, and maybe it's because we're an immigrant generation, right? Culturally, that's just not something we're used to. And it's certainly not a lesson imparted to us by the generation above us, I think. You know, a lot of Asian Americans, I'll speak to myself too. I mean, my parents were not, that's not the kind of thing they were pressing upon me. And it was much the opposite. And so in some ways, I think we, those of us further along in our career in the Asian American community, need to really, I think, make that a point to teach the younger generation or to kind of push them to do, because I think I totally agree with Arun. It's not instinctive the way it may be for others.
Yeah, and I think I totally on the sort of feeling responsibility point. I don't think you and I have ever talked about this, but I totally agree with that sort of feeling responsibility. I think it's not a natural thing, and you got to sort of teach, because again, like my certainly wasn't important to my parents, right? My was about, I'm sure for you, it was like work hard and study. And it's actually interestingly, I think it's also a particularly acute point for Asian Americans, because in the profession, that what Ed just described, the sort of keep your head down, work hard, that will and do well, be very smart. That's actually then going to hurt you. It's not just that you're not going to advance your career, it's going to hurt you because sort of the Asian American stereotype, the sort of worker bee stereotype, right? So I constantly feel like as an, you all need to overcompensate a little bit and not just be the person who's working hard and doing well, because they're going to very quickly pigeonhole you into your, you know, yeah, like Ed's a very smart guy, but he's a worker, but he's never going to bill clients, right? Like he's not that kind of lawyer, but you know, we can, and maybe 30 years ago, 40 years ago in the profession, you can sort of advance in your career and just sort of be the guy in the corner doing good work and writing good briefs, and that's it. But that's not today. That the legal profession's changed too much, and so you know, you got to have all the soft skills, and you got to like find mentors, and you got to. And to me, it's an important part of like what I feel as an obligation to impart on all younger attorneys, but especially sort of Asian American and you know, attorneys of color, women. Just keep promoting that.
So culturally, you know what to hone in on in terms of giving advice.
Oh, when I'm talking to somebody who's South Asian or East Asian, but I'm talking to somebody who's Asian American, I'm very upfront about it. Like, I'm just going to say this to you. And I say this, I'm like, hey, I'm just going to tell you something because I know it was true of me. I'm guessing it's true of you. But like networking, seeking sponsors, building your career that way, I know it's not intuitive to you. Or I'm guessing, because it wasn't intuitive to me. And I'm just like giving you a little bit of unsolicited advice. You got to do it. Don't just work hard and do well. Work hard, do well, but then you also got to do the other stuff. Otherwise, you're not going to advance in your career. And I'm very upfront about it.
Yeah, I think Arun and I may be kind of reading off the same script in that. I'm pretty unvarnished on that. I mean, I think a lot of times I start off by saying the fact that you sought out a mentor is already a great sign, right? And that's more than I ever did. But it's I think I'm not shy about being very blunt about the importance of it.
Arun, have you learned anything from a mentor about the in-house outside litigation counsel dynamic?
So not about that dynamic, but when I went in-house, two things a mentor told me. One is the problems of an outside lawyer sees are like it's the tip of the iceberg, and there tend to be the bigger problems. And being an in-house lawyer is about, there's all this stuff underneath the water, and it's junk, and it's not stuff that is, you know, going to get kicked off to outside counsel necessarily, or it doesn't need to be, but it's really challenging. And like, it's actually a sort of a fun part of the job. The example he was giving is like, you know, yeah, like some SEC investigation comes in. I know what to do. I also know I need to find outside counsel. It totally makes sense. The problems that I have to deal with are like these traders, like they went to a strip club on Friday with like there were men, like that's the problem I have to do. That's not being kicked out to outside counsel, but it's like, what are you guys doing? Right? It's like that sort of thing. That was one thing. Another thing a different mentor told me was, being an in-house lawyer is you don't need to be right 100% of the time. You just need to be right 80% of the time. And that's different than outside lawyers. And I actually haven't found that to be true. And I think I'm right much more than 80% of the time, but nevertheless, that was one thing. And it gets to the point that Ed was making earlier about like the training that he got as a prosecutor. And I think that is right. It's like the ability to make mistakes. And it's okay to make mistakes. And it's something that like lawyers need to learn, because you're not going to be able to make decisions and make good, smart decisions if you're never willing to make a mistake. And one thing that, you know, it was a little funny, but he's like, yeah, you know, when you're the great thing about being, you only need to be right 80% of the time. I was like, okay, fair. And I think I'm right. Again, I think I'm right with much more than that, but in any event.
I think this question has been addressed implicitly in some of your previous answers. Nonetheless, I'd like to ask you directly, as first-generation Americans, do you consider yourselves multicultural to the extent that you identify with and have internalized more than one culture? And if so, has your multiculturalism provided you with inherent skills that have been helpful to you in your practices as litigators?
You want to take the slide?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, no, I do. I do consider myself to be multicultural. You know, I do. I mean, it's something, you know, it's obviously been a part of my identity from day one. What does it mean to me? I mean, it's something that, you know, it's always present. I mean, I feel, especially sort of the immigrant experience, I think it's something I've internalized, right? Where I'm never quite fully in any one culture. And, you know, I'm straddling, maybe different worlds. I'm a Korean American, and there's the Korean culture side of me, and there's the, you know, full blown American side. And, you know, it's something I think that factors in a lot to just, obviously it shaped who I am, but it just, in terms of how I approach the world, I think it has an effect in terms of just, you know, I often think that it inherently makes you a little bit more observant, because you're used to kind of just figuring out, well, how does something run, or, you know, what are the norms in this place? As a litigator / lawyer, you know, there's so many, we probably spent a lot of this, we spent a lot more of this session talking about, you know, big picture, quote unquote, lawyering than, you know, law school lawyering, which is, you know, let's look up the case and see what it says. And, you know, I don't know how, I guess I'm talking less about the effect it would have on the law school textbook lawyering and more on the big picture lawyering about like, okay, well, how do you convert advice or legal analysis into effective advice? And on that, I think it's helped me a lot, because I think it makes me a little bit more sensitive to difference and differences in audience, because I'm different than maybe, you know, another person that I've encountered before or the predominant culture. So I think it has helped equip me with more sensitivity to how to deliver a message to the audience I'm speaking with, and understanding that, you know, maybe the way it would get communicated to a white male may be slightly different than the way it's communicated to an Asian American female, you know, or just sort of understanding that, and being able to, you know, address more effectively the needs of clients who are not American or, you know, come from a different country entirely, and feeling a little bit more comfortable, I think, with, you know, it sounds like pretty basic stuff, but somebody who has zero familiarity with the U.S. way of doing things, that's not a totally foreign concept to me. So I think it's made me more effective as somebody who's able to kind of deliver advice more effectively and meet clients where they're at. I think that's all been an asset.
So it's made you more flexible and adaptable cross-culturally.
If you've always been a member of the dominant culture, and that's what you knew from day one, I think it's harder to adapt to difference. You know, you've had the way, because most of the time you haven't had to adapt. You know, everything is done the way you expect it to be done. And so when you encounter something different can become negative in your mind. Whereas I think if you're bicultural, you've always straddled different worlds and you're always comparing one versus another.
Arun?
I absolutely consider myself bicultural, and I actually don't know sort of the particular environment that Ed grew up in. But I mean, I grew up bicultural, but also like in a community surrounded by a lot of people who didn't speak English in Queens. And I think to Ed's point, it made me very, like a very careful listener and able to communicate in with people who might not be able to understand what I'm saying and learn how to do that. Just like two very practical examples. So one, I think it made me very comfortable in all sorts of environments. It means that I can talk to, a mentor of mine once told me like you can sort of talk to a board of directors and you can also, you know, talk to a cooperator in a criminal investigation. You can meet them at their home in some housing project. And like you're comfortable in both environments, right? I think it made me sort of a good effective communicator and a good listener because you have to be. But that's sort of two sort of very examples. I was once representing a Chinese company in the securities class action case, and they have no context for U.S. litigation, let alone securities cases and class actions, class certification, like none of it, right? And I remember, when we got the case, we're pitching it. And I just walked them through what the next, what it's going to look like and why we would do what we would do, moving to dismiss, blah, blah, blah. And what a class action means. And I remember like very consciously, my wife is East Asian. And I remember very consciously making a choice that I'm going to not speak down to them, but I'm going to explain this the way I would explain this to my in-laws, because that like they're not native English speakers. They don't have an understanding of the legal system. How would I explain this to my wife's father? And that's what I did. And we got the case. It was great. It was good. And they were very happy. And the relationship partner was like, that was so well done. And then very similarly, I think it was like 4 months later, we had a number of Japanese clients come in for like just a it wasn't like a CLE. It was just sort of like a session where we give them what's going on in the U.S. legal, in U.S. law and the and developments and things. And they were like five or six Japanese clients that come in and we give them dinner. We do this in sort of a meet and greet. And I did the same thing. I gave a presentation on, developments in government investigations and what was going on in that world on the U.S. side. Same thing. I was speaking to very sophisticated people, non-native speakers. They were Japanese. They'd flown in from Japan. And I remember I'm going to talk to them as if I'm talking to somebody like my in-laws or to like, some of my parents or somebody in the community that I grew up in, maybe speak English, but didn't speak. How would I explain this to them? And that's what I did. Again, very well received because, again, I'm not talking down to them, but I'm talking, in a way that I'm very conscious of what they understand and what they don't understand. I think that comes from the cultural context in which I, grew up in.
So there's a kind of cultural dexterity that you can bring to your work with people attending educational seminars, or I assume your work with clients that comes from being multicultural yourself.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think being multicultural growing up and in a multicultural environment forced me to learn how to communicate and listen in a way that is it's more challenging, right? You have to listen to people. You have to really pay attention to them to understand what they're trying to say. And you have to be careful in how you communicate with them. And I think that translates forward into being a lawyer. So for example, I'm in an environment where, the person may or may not be a native English speaker or something like that. They may be a native English speaker, but they might, they're not a lawyer. They might be a scientist or a business person. And I think the way it helps me and what's translated is the same skill that I use in listening in my personal life and growing up and being in a multicultural environment, the same listening and communication skills that force you to learn how to communicate with people that are coming from a different context than you are translates, because then when I'm talking to a scientist or a business person and trying to explain a legal concept to them, and they're asking me questions, I'm paying much more careful attention, not just to the words that they're saying, but also trying to really find what they're getting at so I can be most helpful to them.
Now I'd like to switch over to the definition of culture as it applies to the workplace and corporate attitudes, values, expectations, and behaviors. What are some of the big differences you've seen in company cultures?
So one thing, so it's interesting. That's a good question. I think you see there's a lot of variety everywhere, obviously. One thing I'll say, one big difference between my current company and the last company that I worked at is our company is founder driven. It's, there are two co-founders of the company. They're still there. And there's been a culture, at the company that's been a culture for a long time because, and it's still sort of a founder-led company. And they, you know, that means something. And I didn't quite understand what that meant. I was told that when I arrived at the company, but it took me a while to understand what that meant. But my prior company, you know, the CEO, very smart guy, but he was the next CEO, right? He was just there were CEOs before him. There were GCs before him. And there was, you know, and so it's a different in, you know, it's almost like everything's a little less personal, right? I sort of feel like when you're, if you're at a company where, if you're representing a client, I don't know if you found this, where like, you know, you're a financial services company founded by one person, he's there, they drive it. It's like, it's their baby, right? Like they understand they're building something. It's a different thing if you're, you know, some big investment bank and you're, you know, like it's another in-house lawyer, the bank's been around 200 years, they're going to be around another 200 years, who knows, right? And so like, it's sort of a different, I feel like the stakes can sometimes get a little bit different, or the what's important is it can be different depending on that.
Ed, have you noticed some differences?
Yeah, actually, I echo that. I mean, obviously, companies come in all different shapes and sizes, you know, all kinds of different cultures. But one, I think, characteristic that I've definitely seen this in my work, too, when you have sort of, you know, when we represent sometimes the founder of a company, and it can be a small company or a big company, it is very different. It's sort of, to me, I think the representation feels a lot closer to an individual representation when it's the founder's company or the founder and his company. And so I definitely see that as one characteristic that drives a lot of differences in at least the way I experience our client, the culture of our clients. It can feel very different from like sort of the, you know, the family run business versus the, you know, large company where we're dealing with executives who come and go. I certainly see that a lot.
Let's focus on your example. How does a founder-driven company's culture affect the approach you take in your work?
You know, it goes back to a lot of what we've been talking about, understanding what drives decisions and how decisions get made. And, you know, when it's somebody's baby, and it's tied to a person or a family, the decisions are much more personal and you have to take that into account into how you advise on the way forward, right? It's not as far separated from giving advice to a person about what they're going to do. And you know, when it's a lot of times for entrepreneurs, I think the company they create is another child, and so the way your advice gets processed, I think is very different from say, you know, dealing with, let's say, large or publicly held company where you're dealing with executives who aren't necessarily the founders or the creators of the company. So I think the way you render your advice and your assessment of how decisions get made is affected by that.
Yeah. So the one thing I'm curious to get Ed's take on this, and let me just, I'll speak again, not about my current company, but when I was outside counsel, when I was representing companies that were either founder-led or smaller, they were founder-led, they had one company, like, I also found that they tended to be like more risk takers, right? Like they were willing to eat, like they understood the legal advice and they'd be more willing to look like, okay, like I get it, let's go. Whereas I sort of found if I had a big institutional client that had been around forever and it's just another in-house, you know, lawyer that's at the, like, it's a much more, you know, I don't know if arithmetic is the right word, but it's like, all right, what's the pluses, minuses, what are the chances of winning? Okay. And then, you know, whereas like, and it's almost like, and actually I found this when representing individuals, it depends on the individual. There are obviously individuals who are risk averse, but I had one individual in a criminal matter who was a total, you know, willing to roll the dice because he believed, right? And so he was willing to do it. And that's a dynamic, I think, to Ed's point about the different, like, you know, the sort of, a smaller company or a founder-led, you know, company is on some level almost becomes it sort of leans almost towards the individual representation as opposed to the sort of big institutional clients.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it's funny because, you know, the way we experienced it too, you know, we were hired by a hedge fund, you know, almost within a couple of months of having opened our own doors. And I often thought, you know, does this guy know, you know, that we just started and this is the founder of the fund? And he did. You know, he had read a New York Times article describing our founding, and he read that and said, oh, I think I want to hire these guys. And I thought to myself, like, okay, that's quite a big leap of faith there. And but it occurred to me that, you know, this was somebody who also had left the establishment and said, hey, I'm going to start my own thing. And so in some ways, as a law firm, I think the way we experience that is sometimes there's more receptivity to saying, hey, I don't need to hire the big institutional law firm, because, you know, I in some ways made a choice to create something, and I've been very successful. And I sort of know that there's something unique to hiring maybe the upstarts to do this instead of the traditional, big traditional ones. And so I've definitely found that dynamic comes into play as well in a positive way.
Okay, well, let's leave it at that. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks so much. This was a lot of fun.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for listening to the 44th Street podcast of the New York City Bar Association. Opinions expressed are those of the speakers and not necessarily of the City Bar. Find more City Bar podcasts and program audio on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or Stitcher, or at our website at nycbar.org. This podcast was produced by Eli Cohen.